I'm Adam Jansen. I'm the Deputy State Archivist of Washington State, and I have the honor of moderating session 505, Ensuring Authentic Electronic Records, Essential Characteristics, and Archival Preservation. Archivists have traditionally approached authenticity from the perspective of respecting provenance and original order, ensuring a record's content is not lost. To preserve electronic records in an analog environment, often it has been a matter of conserving original documents and record media. In a digital environment where records are even more complex, though, the task of identifying the discrete characteristics that lend meaning and value to records becomes more complicated. Preserving the characteristics that make up an authentic and meaningful electronic record can still be more difficult. We have three distinguished speakers today that will discuss the issues surrounding these characteristics of electronic records and what we need to do with them. Our first speaker is Rick Rogers. He's the president of Finestra Technologies. For those of you who do not know, Finestra is on the Lockheed Martin team that is building the electronic records for the National Archives and Records Administration. Please join me in welcoming Rick.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Chicago. Even though I'm a resident of Maryland, I feel like I've earned my right to welcome you here because I've traveled to Chicago 28 times in the last 18 months. I'm earning my MBA at the University of Chicago, which is just about one block away, so you're in my home territory right now, so I can welcome you here. There are a couple of U of C grads here, and they'll know that this is a picture of the campus, which is down in Hyde Park. And one of the interesting buildings there is the Oriental Institute. I visited there with my grandfather when I was a child, and if you all get a chance, you should go there. They have a wonderful museum there. One of the really interesting artifacts they have there are these clay tablets. There are actually 30,000 of them. They're about the size of a deck of playing cards, and each tablet is written in cuneiform. They were excavated from a palace in Persepolis, which is in Iran, and they date to about 500 BC, and they have writing on them. You might wonder what the writing is. I've got the translation down below. Basically, they're sort of like credit card receipts for the palace, and I've read a lot of the translations because I wanted to sort of see what their credit card receipts were for, and I noticed that most of the receipts are for wine. So this is actually a receipt for an order of wine, and you can see the person who sold the wine to the palace is listed at the bottom. So I'm going to use this example to conduct a little thought experiment. This is just a hypothetical experiment. I've made it up on my own. Imagine you're the curator of these clay tablets, and even though they've lasted for 2,500 years, let's say you find out that you know they're going to decompose in the next few decades. And since this is a thought experiment, I'm going to ask you all to stretch your imagination and imagine that you have limited resources. I know that's a difficult task, but imagine that you have limited resources and that you have to spread them out across many different projects. So the question is, how would you preserve these tablets knowing that they're going to decay in a couple of decades? One thing I need to point out is that these tablets are historically extremely valuable because they're one of the few cases where the Persian Empire wrote about itself. All the other accounts of the Persian Empire we have are from other civilizations like the Greeks. So would you do nothing and let these tablets decay? Who votes for option A? Nobody? I'm glad. Good. You got the right answer. Who would photograph the face of the tablets with high-resolution digital photography and hope that... Okay, we have a couple people who are voting for that. By the way, these are in order of how expensive and time-consuming they are. So if you feel like you have, you need to use your resources wisely, you're going to vote for the earlier options. Who would transcribe and translate the cuneiform? We have a couple of people who would do that. Who would do all three, photograph, translate, and transcribe? The vast majority of the people. And since this is my thought experiment, I get to make up whatever I want. And I'm making up a machine that can, it's a computer machine that scans the clay tablet and creates a 3D model out of it. And then later with this 3D model, I have another machine where I can insert some dirt and some water in the 3D model, and out pops an exact replica of the clay tablet. Okay, so this is expensive to develop, but it's a replica. Who would vote for this? Okay, all right, great. Okay, so why am I talking about clay tablets when I'm supposed to be talking about electronic records? I'd like to switch gears a little bit and talk about electronic records, and I'll come back to the clay tablets at the end of the presentation. This is a screenshot of the movie The Matrix. Some of you may have seen it. And one of the really powerful memes in The Matrix is that we're sort of surrounded by this by information in the digital age, and that the information is fleeting, it's dynamic, it's moving around, swirling around us at all times. And one of the other kind of frightening things about it is the information is essentially almost incomprehensible. In the movie, the information is in kanji or maybe even made up kanji, and it's kind of odd and not comprehensible. And I think this is actually the way things are developing in our digital age. We're surrounded by information all the time. The credit card receipts that were recorded on those clay tablets in cuneiform are now electronic transactions that are zinging around, maybe wirelessly with our iPhones or whatever. And we're just completely surrounded by digital information right now, and some of it's pretty incomprehensible. I'd like to talk about two electronic data sets that are of similar importance to the clay tablets, the Persian clay tablets. And the first is from the 1976 Viking lander mission. And this is a picture taken from the Viking lander, and the purpose of the mission was to try to find out whether there was life on Mars. And the mission successfully landed, and this vehicle sent back a huge amount of digital information to Earth, collected from all the scientific instruments that were on the lander. And NASA analyzed this information and came to the conclusion that there wasn't life on Mars, and put the information onto digital media, onto tapes, and stored the tapes in a good climate-controlled environment. Around 10 to 15 years later, a USC neurobiologist named Joe Miller wanted to conduct some research on the data collected from the mission. So he went to NASA to request this information, and he had three problems. The first problem was NASA didn't know where the tapes were. They eventually found them. They had been stored in a climate-controlled environment, so that they just couldn't easily locate them at first. The second problem is, even though the tapes were high quality when they were created and they were stored using the best sort of physical preservation you can for electronic media, the tapes had degraded in the 15 years that had elapsed since the mission ended. And so the data was actually corrupt. And then the third problem we faced is that the format of the information on the tapes was lost. Either it was never written down in the first place, or it was written down and it was lost. And so he was faced with these corrupt tapes that just had zeros and ones on them, and he could not interpret the scientific information. There was no way to tell which piece of data came from which scientific instrument or what it meant. And the quote from him says that all the programmers had died or left NASA. It was hopeless to try to go back to the original tapes. So here's a case where we have digital information that's highly important to preserve that just in 10 to 15 years became completely unusable. He actually resorted to going back to the computer printouts, and he hired a team of people, probably students, to rekey the information from scratch in a modern computer system, and then he performed his research on that information. And he found that some evidence that there were possibly some microorganisms in the soil on Mars. So actually, with his new research that was conducted 20 years after the mission, he came up with some evidence that there might be life on Mars. So that just kind of illustrates the importance of the information that was on those tapes. Now I'd like to talk about the 1986 BBC Doomsday Project. The original Doomsday book is pictured here. William the Conqueror, after he conquered England in 1086, he ordered a census of all of England. His main point was to figure out how he could tax people. I've actually read parts of it when I was in Oxford. It's pretty interesting. It lists every single cow, pig, and sheep in all of England at the time. In 1986, the BBC commissioned a project. They paid £5 million for it. And it was a kind of a modern-day census of England. They used some data from the UK census, but they also collected submissions from elementary school kids, stories and articles about their town, and they kind of gathered all this information together into a multimedia project. And their idea was they were going to sell the end result to schools, and schools would use it for teaching purposes. And I actually have a colleague who grew up in Manchester who submitted an entry to the Doomsday Book. In the early 90s, people realized that the information in this Doomsday Book was inaccessible. Okay, so it's only 5 or 10 years after it was created, it's no longer available. And this was a huge cultural resource. They had spent £5 million in many, many years developing this resource, and it became inaccessible. So why was it inaccessible? Well, first, they built it for a system called Acorn, a computer system. I don't know if any of you have ever heard of it. It was very popular in England at the time, maybe not the rest of the world, and it doesn't really exist anymore. The second problem is they used those big laser discs that were kind of precursors to the CD-ROMs, and those also had a very short life, supportable life as well. And then the third problem is that the information on those discs was in a proprietary format. They had written sort of custom software for it, and they had developed all this kind of layers of architecture on top of it, and no commercial product like Microsoft Word or something could read these files at all. So the UK National Archives started two different research projects to try to recover this information, and one involved emulation, which I'll talk about in a minute, and the other involved migration, which I'll also talk about. But the point that I want you to take away from this chart is just how quickly things can become obsolete. It only took five or 10 years for it to become obsolete. And one of the reasons why it became obsolete is the group that was hired to build this project was fired when it was a commercial failure. And so there was no kind of organizational support infrastructure for maintaining this information. And that's one of the key reasons why it became obsolete. And the quote from one of the people who worked on the recovery effort said, "We must not make the mistake of thinking that recording on a long-lived medium gives us meaningful preservation." Okay, so when we're talking about obsolescence for physical records, like the clay tablets, there are really three kinds of obsolescence: loss, degradation, and destruction. These are the main things that concern you if you're talking about preserving paper records or clay tablets or what have you. Technological obsolescence involves preservation for digital records involves also technological obsolescence. I've talked about all of these: media format obsolescence, those big laser discs, they can't be read anymore. Data format obsolescence, the Viking lander tapes, nobody understood what the format was of the data, so they couldn't use it. And then operating system and hardware platform obsolescence, the Acorn computers that were the most popular computing platform in England at the time they chose it, disappeared after 5 or 6 years. So here's kind of a chart of the different sort of relative timelines. This is not super scientific. This is just my own searching around on the web trying to figure out what some of the relative ranges are. So don't take this as gospel. But this gives you a sense of the sort of the duration you can expect. This is sort of min and max duration that you can expect on these different things. And so the main point that I want you to take away from this is not the exact numbers, but the idea that all of the technological obsolescence can occur just as quickly as 1 to 2 to 3 decades. So that's really how long these things last. And compare that to 2,500 years for the clay tablets and 900 years for the Doomsday Book. And you can see that there's a big problem with technological obsolescence in digital records. So the thing that we'd like to do is pick the longest duration technology. We'd like to think that we're smarter and that we could pick the CD-ROMs instead of the laser discs, or that we would pick the Windows machine instead of the Acorn machine, or whatever. But as we know from 1989, when the Iron Curtain unexpectedly fell, sometimes things happen that completely surprise and baffle experts. So technology tends to kind of grow incrementally, and then every once in a while it's punctuated by this period of just complete disruption where something just totally brand new comes out and it disrupts and degrades the previous generations of technology before it, in the same way that the Iron Curtain falling was a complete disruptive surprise. I mean, a very good one, but also very, very much a surprise. And just in the last 30 years, we've had, for example, in something like a generic word processing application, we've had WordStar, WordPerfect, Xywrite, Word, and now OpenOffice Writer, and who knows what's going to be next. So we can't just depend on picking the longest duration technology, because we don't really know what it is, and even if we did pick the longest duration technology, it will become obsolete perhaps faster than we expect. So what to do? Here's a number of different tactics that archivists and other people have developed for addressing this problem. And I'm going to talk about two of them, migration and emulation, on the next two slides. I want to point out that the two that are probably most in use, which are the first and third one, which are refreshing and replication, those are probably the most widely used ones right now, and they both really only address the physical obsolescence of the media. They don't really address the technological obsolescence, and that's the much thornier problem. So let's talk about emulation. This is an emulator of an Atari game console written in a modern-day programming language, Java, and running in a web browser. I picked this because I have a lot of hours in my misspent youth playing video games like this, but also because it shows what emulation does really well. Emulation involves basically writing a program that acts like the platform that you're trying to emulate. So an Atari console is like a little box that sits under your TV. You guys have probably seen it. This is a Java program that acts just like that box. It's written in a way that it does everything that that box does. The problem with emulation is that in today's software world, there's layer upon layer upon layer of hardware and layer upon layer upon layer of software, and the number of interactions between all these different layers just exponentially increases as you add the layers. I don't know if you've ever had this experience, but I have, where you call your help desk and say, I have a problem with my word processing application, and they ask you 1,000 questions, and by the end of it, you find out that the problem is really somewhere else. It's in something that you installed recently or in your operating system or in something, the way your computer is set up, and it has nothing to do with the original application. And the problem with emulation is that it's very difficult for it to emulate all these different layers and all this complexity. Just for example, Microsoft Windows XP has 40 million lines of code, and if you were to emulate it, you'd probably have to write 40 million lines of code, and I don't think the SAA can really afford that to fund that project. So let's talk about migration. Migration is another strategy. This is a picture of the Sistine Chapel. As many of you know, the Sistine Chapel was restored in the 80s and early 90s. And it was very controversial when it was first begun. The picture on the left is before the restoration, and on the right is after the restoration. It's a little dark in here, but the basic idea is the picture on the left has a brown patina on it, and that patina has developed over the years because of all the smoke from the candles they use inside the Vatican. And the picture on the right has very bright, almost garish colors. And so this was a very controversial restoration when it happened. And the question really hinged on, what was Michelangelo's original intent? Did he anticipate that these paintings would develop this brown patina? And did he pick bright colors on purpose, knowing that they would dull over time? And it's almost an impossible question to answer, because Michelangelo didn't write down what his intentions were when he painted the Sistine Chapel, in the same way that the NASA Viking landing programmers didn't write down what their intentions were with the zeros and ones on those tapes that were lost. So the point about migration is you're taking a digital file and converting it from one format to another, the same way that the Sistine Chapel restoration artists changed the original painting in some way in order to preserve it. And the question is, have you done that in a way that's authentic, that preserves sort of the essence of the original? And that's the real question. The other question is, with migration, it's not a one-time shot. Remember, I said technological obsolescence happens every few decades. You can't just do it once and then assume you're done. You're going to have to do it and redo it and redo it. And as you have successive generations of migration, the question is, are you drifting off of the original too much? And that's a real issue. So the part of the answer to that is the essential characteristics. And my next two colleagues are going to be talking about this. David's going to be talking about what some essential characteristics are, and Manfred will be talking about some practical ways to implement essential characteristics. But the example I'd like to use for this is this Getty Kuros statue. If any of you have read Blink, you already know what the punchline for this story is. But this statue was purchased by the Getty Museum for around $10 million. Before they purchased it, they assessed its provenance and had a battery of tests, scientific tests, to see if it was real or not. And they concluded that it was real. A number of art historians who looked at it after they had purchased it concluded that it was a forgery. They had just kind of an instinctive, intuitive feel that it was a fake. They couldn't really even say why. They just sort of had this gut feeling that it was a fake. So in order to settle the controversy, Getty convened an international conference. 19 papers were presented, arguing both for and against whether this was authentic. And the results were inconclusive. There's a lot of points that show that it's authentic and a lot of points that show that it was forged. One of the objective points that show that it's authentic is the marble has a certain kind of aging that can only occur over centuries, or so scientists thought. Later they found out that if you rub potato mold on marble and then bury it for 3 months, it achieves the same effect. I don't know why potato mold. But the art historians had some subjective assessments of the authenticity, which had to do with, is this consistent with the style? There was a question about the fingernails on the statue being in a modern style. So it's really, the point I want to make is that essential characteristics, when we're looking at whether the results of either an emulation or a migration strategy have produced an authentic record, we need to take into account both objective and subjective considerations the same way they did in this debate. So that's really all I wanted to say. Now I want to circle back. These conclusions, I'm not going to read through them. You can look at them later. But I wanted to circle back to our clay tablet discussion. So those of you who voted to do nothing, which is none of you, thankfully, are in the camp of performing preservation on digital records. The scenario I set up with the clay tablet is that the tablets are going to decay in a few decades, and that's the exact same situation we face with electronic records if they're not preserved. They will decay in a few decades. They will be unreadable and unusable, the same way the Viking lander records were unusable after 15 to 20 years, and the same way the BBC Doomsday Project was unusable in 15 to 20 years. So if you want to do something to preserve these vital digital records, you need to have a preservation strategy. Those of you who voted to photograph or transcribe or translate the clay tablets were voting for a migration strategy. Okay, so you're taking kind of what is the essence, the essential part of those cuneiform tablets, which is the writing on them, and you're capturing them either through images or through writing, but you're actually transforming them out of their clay tablet form into another form, which is a piece of paper with either a picture on it or writing. So you're actually performing a migration strategy on the tablets. And those of you who voted for my amazing tablet replicating machine were voting for emulation. And just in the simple example that I gave, you can see how that's kind of a fantastical example of what it would take to do emulation. And you can kind of understand what some of the practical considerations are in building emulators for digital records. So with that, I'd like to thank you, and I'll turn it over to David.
Before we continue on with our next speaker, I am supposed to remind everyone that due to fire regulations, we need to keep the aisleways clear and the doorways clear. So if we could please, we've got some seats up here, that would be greatly appreciated. Now, our first speaker, who will be speaking second, is David Miller. He's a senior records analyst with the National Archives and Records Administration based in the Mid-Atlantic region in Philadelphia. So please welcome David Miller.
I guess we archivists aren't so good at math, but yeah. One comes after two today. As you probably know, the U.S. National Archives and Records Administration is engaged in a multi-year effort to build the Electronic Records Archives, or ERA, to preserve electronic records for generations and technologies to come. More precisely, ERA seeks to ensure the reproducibility of essential characteristics of electronic records over time. Easy enough. To give you the full scope of this requirement, the ERA system glossary seeks to define these essential characteristics as those that must remain unchanged through the transfer, ingest, storage, and presentation or output of records. Wow. Perhaps I'm being a little too literal about this, but in the realm of digital records, how do we begin to identify and define something as ineffable as essence, and what do we mean by that? And once we do that, once we define that essence, how do we ensure this essence remains unchanged through the life of the record? Now, today's archivist must flinch at least a little bit hearing a goal like that. I'm here to lay out some of the issues to confront if we are to preserve records that maintain their essential characteristics, ones that remain trustworthy and authentic to their users over time. And while I may use NARA terminology and reach into the ERA program to help focus the discussion, I don't speak for NARA management in general or the ERA program in particular. I need to make that caveat at this point. But what I'll describe is not necessarily reflective of how ERA will work when it's deployed or of how NARA will operate when that day might come. Due to that fact, this is all somewhat notional. It's the beginning of the conversation rather than a finished product. I hope our other speakers will get into more practical elements of digital preservation as Rick started the conversation. I'll focus on our place in the federal records lifecycle and how we might incorporate the concept of essence as in our appraisal, our preservation, and reference practices if we ever hope to satisfy our users' need for authentic electronic records. Oops, stepping forward a little bit. On essence, we don't start from scratch, not completely from scratch at least. We can look to archival theory, to international standards, to law, to professional practice and within our institutions. And in many cases, we already have a rich language to describe these essential characteristics, or at least a foundation of authority lists and schema, taxonomies and templates that we can press into partial service in this effort. And while essence may be too poetic a way to describe records ultimately, it's not out of line with our traditional agenda to provide access to reliable and authentic records. After all, we're always trying to refine the meanings and values of the records in our holdings, so why not essence? Our exploration of essence has to begin with the record creator. And while NARA has no real way to dictate the federal agency's day-to-day work processes, our regulations are part of the web that rein in the creators of federal records. We rely on them to create the appropriate records for the work they do today so that we may preserve them for users in the future. Even before the archives gets involved, the many users of records, creators, customers, citizens, they need the assurance that what they have before them is authentic, at least sufficiently so to do business. So for their purposes, it might be that the essence of any business record is that which makes it trustworthy. You know, that's great, but that's not quite enough guidance to build an electronic records preservation program around. So how is an archivist to appraise and describe and preserve and provide access to this essence over time? To support a small piece of the ERA development effort, a team of archivists and records managers and technologists at NARA began looking at the types of records we most typically encounter in the federal government. We're more or less comfortable preserving these sorts of records already. The federal government is producing terabytes and terabytes worth of these sorts of records, and NARA has committed to preserve some of these records for a long time, if not permanently. So it makes sense to start here, at least. Specifically, these record types, as they are termed in NARA's Lifecycle Authority Guide, are databases, digital photography, digital text, email, GIS, and web records. That's where we started. So on to the results of our efforts. After exploring these record types, the NARA team identified the main families or clusters of characteristics that archivists may need to identify and preserve throughout the lifecycle. For us Anglophones, it works out quite well that without too many gymnastics, we can talk about the ABCs of essential characteristics: appearance, behavior, context, and structure. I'll go into each one of those in detail. Honest, we really didn't plan the ABC part. That happened pretty close to the end. First, let's look at appearance characteristics. And I don't know how useful this diagram is going to be, but you're going to see a couple like this as I go on. These are expressing the visual attributes of a record, the layout, the color, and text attributes of a record. Please note that this diagram and the others to follow are not comprehensive, but serve as an illustration of how attributes may be characterized for the most common records in our digital holdings. Still, the level of detail here may be instructive. For some records, we may recognize a need to describe the layout and color and text attributes much more fully than others. And this diagram merely shows a menu of attributes that could be associated with records that we've got in our repositories already. And I don't know how viewable that is from you out there, but we've got some sort of broken down by text, layout, and color with some explanation of what we mean by layout. Layout could include a record's orientation, pagination, and proportion. And for some records, color could include brightness, hue, and content, and contrast attributes. And there are a host of ways to describe the appearance of text in our digital records, its own orientation and color, as well as font. To identify these appearance characteristics, we can follow many of our current descriptive practices, and we probably should follow our current descriptive practices. We already know how to describe the photographs in our holdings, so it's not really a great leap from there to describing the essential appearance characteristics found in a trustworthy digital photograph. For these records, for such records of fixed appearance, it is important to preserve the way that they look and feel and to be able to present them to users in the future, at least to their satisfaction. After all, it's their perception of what is trustworthy and authentic that we're trying to meet. Databases would be the other extreme. The visual characteristics of a database are rarely, if ever, essential. Now, this example shows this thinking applied to a single one of our record types and in far, far less detail than the previous image. For this hypothetical system of GIS records, represented by the cloud here, preserving the visual layout would be essential. Hence the solid red line pointing from the GIS records to the layout attributes, which here would include things like orientation and scale and proportion. And to the extent that color and text are employed in such a system, And to the extent that color and text are employed in the system, these attributes too would be essential. But since the use of color and text are somewhat optional in GIS, these attributes are more conditional in nature, thus the dotted line between the GIS cloud and text and color attributes. Obviously, this is very, very simplified. Now, where the solid and dotted lines go would depend not merely on the record type, here GIS, but also on the informational and evidential value of the records at hand. This is an appraisal decision. As a rule, if the visual aspect of a record is mutable, that is, if it's supposed to look different from computer screen to computer screen, it is less likely to be essential to maintain. However, if the record's appearance is static, we might assume that it is that way for a very, very good business reason, and we might consider this fixed appearance essential to preserve. Next, behavior. This is the ability to perform queries, manipulate, and display the records. In a digital environment, it may be necessary to specify what sorts of operations or processes can be applied to a record object. Every record exhibits the most basic behavior of occupying a place within an order imposed by its creator. Though, of course, in a digital world, it's more and more likely to be virtual and logical order rather than our traditional physical order that we maintain. Nevertheless, the behavior of displaying a record is essential to preserve. We may also wish to preserve the ability to replicate certain built-in queries if these are determined to have ongoing value. Likewise, the various ways users are able to manipulate the records, especially for web records and GIS and other complex systems, these behavioral or functional elements may require significant analysis, and it may be beyond us at the moment to preserve these complex interactions and functions. The archival language we have to describe behavior may not quite be as rich as for other families of characteristics. We may need to think more and more about how a record's behavior affects how users determine authenticity and how these behaviors could bear on a record's meaning. We might anticipate that our users will grow more and more savvy and have greater and greater expectations of us regarding the functionality of the records we preserve and present to them. A GIS record, for example, may include elements drawn from dozens of different map layers. To present an authentic record from a GIS, the essential characteristics would include the operations needed to retrieve the essential data, retrieve the required data from the appropriate layers, and then cause them to display correctly to the user. And in some systems, the maps can be manipulated in complex ways, contouring, zooming, shading, rotating, etc., which may also need to be identified and preserved in the appraisal process and then preserved thereafter. On to context. Now, context is something we can get our arms around. We start licking our lips as archivists and we start hearing about context. We probably could have started there, but then it would be CAB instead of ABC, and that doesn't quite work as well. So I'm sort of forcing the structure a little bit, but work with me here. Now, typically, we make it our business need to learn all we can about the organizational and functional contexts out of which records are born. Records have meaning insofar as they are linked intellectually to a record series or system. And as a general rule, you could say a record's most essential characteristic is its link to the context of its creation and use. Its meaning and its recordness, really, depends on it being a trustworthy and authentic link in a business process. Still, this rule isn't quite enough to build a system around. Note that the two general attributes associated with context, series information and descriptive metadata, are open to elaboration. Typically, we would not discard or fail to preserve whatever contextual metadata are associated with the records, whether that's complete or not. The nature of the metadata may vary widely from record type to record type and from system to system. For these context characteristics, our traditional emphasis on maintaining provenance will serve us quite well. We can decide whether the records we accession are sufficiently situated within their business processes to be considered authentic upon arrival, and if their context is preservable into the future. The descriptive metadata that could describe the context of records is extensible, and we have an ever-growing body of standards to help us here. To complete the GIS example, these records may or may not follow a descriptive standard such as the Federal Geographic Data Standard or ISO 19115. So you see the dotted line here between GIS and the descriptive metadata. But we must always have sufficient contextual information for the record series or system in order to make it in the archival front door, much less be worthy of our preservation efforts. So we see the solid line between GIS and the record series information. We always need that. We see the solid line to the series information because that's always the case for all the record types. Underpinning all these families of characteristics would be structure. To preserve any digital record, we must certainly understand the technical structure. This includes the way the data are encoded, the schemas that are employed, and for some types of records, perhaps even to bit depth and compression values. To describe these structure characteristics, we looked at the world of data standards, specialized extensible metadata schema, and format registries, among other resources. Even simplified like this, you can see how complicated this diagram would be. And as we get into more and more complex data formats and record types, it'll be even more and more complex. The NARA team produced conceptual diagrams for all the record types we examined, those six that I mentioned before, not just these GIS examples. Some are far more complicated than others, as I said. You know, while the characteristics of digital photography and databases are fairly simple to illustrate, of the record types we studied, email and web records were far, far more problematic due to their variability and complexity. Portions of a website's content, for example, may be derived from a series of databases, and these underlying databases could be treated as such. But the site could also include photographs and text and sound and a host of interactive functions. The characteristics of these would have to be appraised in turn and preserved appropriately. So those are the results of the six record types that we first started looking at. And I want to spend a second talking about the record's life cycle from at least the stage of appraisal through preservation and eventual presentation to a future user. Some of these attributes or the attributes themselves are absolutely essential to preserve. By that I mean an archives cannot be said to provide access to the authentic record if they're not preserved. A database may be composed of a number of tables and a primary key, and preserving this structure would be essential to maintaining the meaning and value of that database. If these are lost, the physical fact that we may preserve media with data on them would not change the intellectual fact that the record isn't preserved at all. Other characteristics are conditional, in that if they aren't preserved, whether by the record creator in the first place or whichever preserving organization that follows, the record may still retain meaning and have value to secondary users. For example, maps in a GIS might be plotted to a certain scale and orientation and may use very fine color gradations to illustrate environmental characteristics. One might imagine a circumstance, like metadata corruption, say, or the use of a non-standard data format, where the preserver of these GIS records is unable to maintain these precise color values in the original system. So these attributes will not quite match the original. While this might make those maps less useful, The maps aren't necessarily rendered meaningless or inauthentic by this preservation strategy. Whereas if we could not preserve the map layer's scale and orientation and present them accordingly to a user, it's likely the records will not satisfy the user. Whatever preservation path we choose, whatever impediments we encounter that prevent us from preserving record attributes, we'll need to document what we've done in an effort to keep these digital records alive. Some characteristics are objective values, and their technical verification and preservation may be easily automated and preserved. Others are far more subjective and will require a considerable archival, curatorial, and technical judgment and some harsh policy decisions along the way to identify and preserve these things. Whatever preservation strategies we employ will be influenced by the particular record series, record type, and data format in question. And of course, the decisions we make early in the life cycle will have to be articulated in order to be useful in the presentation of authentic, trustworthy records later on in the life cycle. So how might this look in practice? Again, this is notional. Early on in the life cycle, while the records are still in the custody of their creators, and perhaps even as a digital system is being designed, the archival authority will determine the nature and value of the records and justify that appraisal decision. And as part of the justification for permanent or long-term records, the ones the ERA is likely to be asked to preserve, we would articulate these characteristics that are essential to the meaning and ongoing value of the records. Now, sometime later, these records would be transferred into the custody of ERA, in the custody of the archives. The creating agency would vouch for their authenticity using whatever internal controls it requires to meet its business needs. And the archives would perhaps not accept the records into its holdings until verifying the persistence of the attributes identified at initial appraisal. At this stage, we can certainly revise our understanding of the record's characteristics, since they may have been overtaken events as time passes, as data formats and record content have evolved since time of appraisal. So this is an opportunity for reappraisal along the life cycle. So once these essential characteristics of a body of records have been identified and described to whatever level of detail we think is appropriate, we should be able to measure the success of our subsequent preservation activities against these characteristics. And after we employ a preservation strategy of whatever sort, we should be able to ask ourselves if the records we present to our researchers are essentially those that we accessioned. Do they retain sufficient meaning and value, or their essence, for our users to perceive them as trustworthy and authentic? Again, this is somewhat a subjective judgment on the part of our user communities. During initial appraisal and then again and again throughout the preservation stage of the life cycle, we'll have two basic questions to ask. One, is the characteristic or attribute essential to the meaning of the record? And two, is it essential to the evidential or informational value of the record? These are still very early days in the development of ERA, and what I've outlined here is not solidified into practice throughout the organization, much less throughout the profession. It's still too early to tell if essential characteristics as a construct will be essential or useful to complex archival organizations struggling to preserve their most valuable electronic records. Perhaps this discussion can lead us to better express what we find meaningful and valuable in our records and serve as a foundation as we build the mechanisms we'll need to test our assumptions over time. So ends the theory and the philosophy and the framework portion of the session. I hope that the practitioners have more to say about the practical elements of putting this into action. So on to Manfred to talk more about that.
As we take a brief pause before our third speaker, I will again make a plea for the fire marshal to keep the stairs and the doorway clear. We have plenty of seats up here. There's some back there. And as a courtesy to your fellow archivists, please make sure all cell phones are muted. So our third speaker, the one who will enlighten us with the okay, now what do we do, we have Manfred Thaler. He has a PhD in modern history as well as postdoctorate in sociology from the Institute of Advanced Studies in Vienna. He is a research fellow at the Max Planck Institute for History from 1978 through 1997. The director of the Humanities and Information Technology Program in Bergen, Norway from 97 to 2000, and is now the professor of Humanities and Computer Science in Cologne, Germany. So please welcome Manfred.
Thank you very much. Well, ladies and gentlemen, it's a great pleasure for me to speak to you. So, as you have heard from my biography, I'm not exactly an archivist. So I have been involved very much in cultural heritage digital projects where it turned out that this is not the first time that I am talking to archivists. Well, you have heard from the title that I'm talking about practical work which is happening within a project called Planets. This is an attempt among some of your European colleagues and some people in Europe who are not your direct colleagues but are closely related to the sector to work consistently on a couple of problems of digital preservation. Not only the detail we are discussing here, but also some other questions like, for example, risk assessment. If you have a couple of digital files, how do you find out which of them are the most endangered ones by the perils we have heard described here so vividly? This is a reasonably large project, which is co-funded by the Union by a relatively substantial budget, but I should point out if you spread even a large amount of money over an all-purpose project, it's not that big as it may look like. These are the goals somewhat in detail. On the one hand, improve the possibilities of archivists and librarians for making sensible decisions. Secondly, work practically on the problems and try to make as much of the process of preservation automatic as possible. I'll come back to that, why that's so central. That's the crew. Some institutions which are somewhat close to what you're doing. Some which you should recognize as your immediate colleagues, a couple of technology units in relatively small niches, a couple of companies, the niches of which aren't quite that small, and some people from the research crowd, including my own institution. Now, why do we, in the context of such an overall project, where, as I would like to emphasize, characterization of digital resources is only one aspect, why do we want to characterize it all? Well, first of all, to answer the question you see in front of you, after you have migrated, and there I'm totally in agreement with Rick that that's probably the technology to be used for the bulk of the cases, how do you make sure that after you have migrated from one format to another one, you actually still have the same amount of information? Second question, if you have more than one copy, as all the more sensible long-term projects propose, if you compare them at the moment, you can only find out whether they are identical. But it would be quite sensible if you would also have a chance to find out which of the ones has actually been damaged. Now, the vision is quite simple. You have a file in one format, for example, this, which is called PNG, an image file, which you have migrated into a second format. Now, remember, we want to make everything as automatic as possible. Therefore, we assume that we do have a chunk of software called an extractor, which is somewhat informed about the properties of formats, meaning that it has a specification of what these formats mean in terms which a machine, not a human programmer, but which a machine can understand. doing so, it then supposes to extract the information which is contained in these two files and bring them into a representation which is independent of the individual formats, which allows another chunk of software to work on it and come up with some guess how similar they actually are. The reason that you see something in cartoon style about this 93% is that it should be clear that making a very exact, precise quantitative statement, how identical, say, an office document is after it has been converted to PDF, is not exactly simple. So while we work on quantitative metrics to achieve such things, we are, well, very open to the fact that some considerably much more work is, has to be done to do that in any precise way. There exists a second version of the same vision. You have two copies. Unfortunately, time is gnawing on both of them, or at least one of them, which is a totally dissimilar process to migrating them, but which can be fit into the same process by coming up with another statement where the result shows clearly that I've used cut and paste. Okay. Now, the rest, up to a degree, I could skip because they are technical details, but they may nevertheless be of some interest how we intend to achieve such things. Well, if we look more closely at the diagrams which I've shown you, there are four building blocks for such a scenario. First of all, you have to make it possible that a computer, a chunk of dedicated software, is doing something which traditionally IT specialists have been doing. That is, writing a program which is able to read things which are stored according to a format specification. All these formats you have heard about, PDF, DOC, TIFF, and so on, exist as written documents starting with about 80 pages for TIFF, coming to about 2,600 for PDF, and a not yet totally clear number of thousands of pages for the new X-based Microsoft formats. But still, this is a collection of paper which a human programmer reads, understands, hopefully, and writes a program which is doing something useful. The idea is basically create a language which allows to translate from a human-readable description of a format into something which a machine can understand so that our programmer doesn't have to write the individual program for each file format, but basically one relatively tricky one which should be able to interpret that language. Okay, that's one of the details which we probably could skip over, but just to show what in principle I mean, the bottom part is the excerpt from a specification of this language of a PDF format, which is responsible for extracting the document offer, which may be quite important as a for authentication. Now, XEL is designed to be able to allow the expression of all existing file formats. That's an intellectual purpose of a Planet's project, or rather of a sub-project which I'm representing. I would like to point out, however, that though for years are relatively long-term, we do not really intend to translate all the 16,000 major ones which are known so far, nor do we really hope that we can make all of the 2,600 pages of a PDF specification workable. I mean, we follow their policy, which shows a little bit the computer science background, try to go for a very general solution, but modify your idealism by pragmatism and try to realize something which is useful within the more general model. You could also, if you wanted to be more poetic, say, look at the stars, but keep your feet safely on the ground. Well, four building blocks. Second one, produce an extractor program which is actually able to use such a specification to extract the information which is in a file. Well, a prototype for a GUI version of such a tool looks like this, which shall more or less prove that we are actually producing something. It's probably not very sensible to discuss what you see at the moment. Now, this extractor is designed to be useful in real life, and then I would like to add a few numbers. If we talk about long-term preservation, some of the archives we are supporting have to expect that they will receive in the near future, say, 1 million of digital files every year. At least the National Archives in the U.S., I'm quite sure, will also receive something on that order of magnitude in the near future if they don't receive considerably more. Now, let us just do some small arithmetic. If you spend 1 second with each of these files, that's already roughly 2 working weeks. Now, computers don't have Sundays off, so it's only 11.5 days. But it means 2 challenges. On the one hand, if a computer needs 1 minute today, it probably needs 5 seconds 5 to 10 years from now, and it needs less 5 years after that. If a human being needs 1 hour today, his or her successor 10 years from now will probably need 59 minutes. But in any case, not considerably less, nothing on these changes of orders of magnitudes we had before. Therefore, we face 2 challenges. On the one hand, we have to try to make the whole thing really automatic. That's part of the challenge. And secondly, unfortunately, we cannot play around with prototypes, but we have to go for software which actually performs. Building block the third. When I said produce a program which extracts the data described by the format from a file, this information, of course, has to be expressed somehow. That's what building block the third is about. That's a wonderful case of cutting and pasting a little bit too much. What it actually should propose is describe the content by a formal specification and provide a language which allows you to express the content of a file. Now, to do that, if we want to express the content of a file, we have to express it in a general model. For example, if we go to Rick's example of clay tablets, one of the policies he proposed was to transcribe the content of his clay tablets onto paper. Now, that is possible because we have an underlying, for rarely made explicit, model of what written text is. So you can transfer it from one implementation of that model into another one. Similarly, we have developed for computer-readable material an abstract model of what an image is, as well as a model what a text is. So the trick is, if you have 2 image formats, extract the information from these, make 2 abstract representations of the content, do the same for text, I have to admit, with sound and 3D, we have not made very much more than played a little bit to make sure that some of the basic decisions are sound. But the first two, we are rather serious about. So this means that we have two formal languages. The left one describes for example, where in the file you find information about the height of an image. So that's a specification where in a certain class of image files you find the height. This is the kind of result you get, telling you what the height of one specific file is. So, we intend, in principle, to provide an abstract language to represent the full content of a file. This more or less means that we do not really extract in characteristics, but at least potentially we translate the whole thing into a format-independent representation, which means that we play a couple of technical tricks which may not be proper to discuss here. Why do we do so? Now, let us look at the compression of a file, okay? I think you all know the principle. You have a file which has 100 megabytes. You run a compression algorithm over it. It shrinks down to 10, and you can save it. Now, the point is, after you have decompressed it, you see exactly what has happened before, what has been there before the compression, right? So this would, for example, qualify in principle as one of the optional characteristics David has been speaking of, because strictly speaking, that's not a characteristic of a file. Once you have decompressed it, you have all of the information. Librarians probably agree. Some of your archivist colleagues don't. Because if we look at the clay tablet example again, there's one basic difference between physical records and digital records, and that is that the authenticity of physical records usually can be explored, if nothing else suffices, by physical methods. That is, you can find out whether a clay tablet is 5,000 years old or not, but you cannot necessarily easily find out whether a digital file has been written 2 days ago or 20 years ago. Part of the answer, this is in itself is an intriguing topic, which I won't follow here, part of the answer is that we assume that we will extract properties of a file in such a way that you can create a history of that. And in the year 2107, an archivist or historian who discovers that a digital document claims to have been compressed by an algorithm in the year 2007, which has been invented only in the year 2057, might get doubts, which are quite familiar if you're used to the critique of documents in a more traditional way. However, we really do extract the actual data. Now, this seems to be nonsense because characteristics are usually supposed to be vaguely related to the concept of metadata, of information about the data you're actually processing, not the data themselves. Well, let's look at some of the first steps. I should say we work on that only about a year. On the first steps for building block the fourth. What we did to test our approach was to take the official benchmark of an image format called PNG and translate it with an industry standard program, Photoshop, almost certainly all of you have heard about, and transfer it into another format. And then we had the bright idea, if our software works, it must point out that these two sets of files are identical. Well, if you have very good eyes, you may discover in the fourth column here that the long red things proclaim the unfortunate message of failed. Now, what actually happens if you use Photoshop to apply to convert the official test files of one formal specification into another? The following thing happens. Now, of course, if you look at it, you see immediately that these are different. But remember, we are talking about millions of files, and we are not talking about one person who sits in front of a computer and after a million files has been migrated to look at each of them, whether that actually has been successful. Now, the problem is you can extract everything from these two files, and they will be declared to be totally identical. The only error which Photoshop makes is in the data themselves. So you might have perfectly correctly characterized data which don't work. Now, this looks a little bit like squaring a circle. We said just about everything you have in a file at all, you may need to evaluate its status, its authenticity. However, if you do not storage optimize a format, you'll need at least one order of magnitude, that's IT speak, for multiply by a number of 10. You will need at least one order of magnitude more storage than for optimized format. And if you're talking about having 50 terabytes every month or year now, multiplying that by 10 may not look as such a brilliant proposition. If we are safe, however, that we can keep the file specifications in such a way that we need only one program, which has been called extractor before, to apply them to what we have saved originally, we arrive at the concept of just-in-time characterization extraction, which is at the moment one of the ideas we are more intrigued with. Okay, this is a concrete project, so let me report briefly on where we are. The languages and the first software block have been designed in a very general way, and they support some formats initially. We are starting in stage two on the automatic comparison of the stuff. That's what we intend to do. You may be a bit surprised that a relatively big project uses square brackets and question marks in such an intensity. There's a very simple reason, because, as I said, this is a real-world, a real-life project, but it's also an academic research project. And in a sense, I would be very intrigued to find a totally general format for games, for example. But the sad and sorry truth is that our customers, your colleagues, actually hold 99.some% of Office documents, plus image files, plus sound files, and all the more attractive things are a little bit beyond that. Which is the reason why, for some of the question marks, and some of the question marks may be intriguing, we will probably do what the group we are supposed to support really needs, means focusing on these slightly more trivial formats. Thank you very much.
So those are our three speakers. We have about 15 minutes left in the session for questions to our august panel. So anyone? Anyone? Bueller? Bueller? I have a question I think that'll be useful to the group that I think, where do we start? Do you have recommendations on either concepts, policies, theories, books, websites, educational opportunities? You could each share one little nugget with the group. What would it be?
Well, I mean, a very good idea would be to start with the Library of Congress, who has a very good website on these questions. I assume some of you should know the URL by heart. I don't, for I quote it quite frequently.
Rick? Can you say that again, Matt? They couldn't hear you.
Oh. Sorry. I said I would actually start at the Library of Congress because we have a very good website on the practical implications of file formats. And before all these wonderful things which the community is thinking about are in place, it might be a very good idea to start with relatively low-level considerations of what to do to the formats you have, which to choose and which not to choose. I quote this URL quite frequently, but I admit I don't know it by heart, but maybe some of the other speakers do.
Is this on? Yeah. I don't know. We started with the low-hanging fruit, at least the National Archives, the records that we're really most comfortable with, and coming up with ideas there to refine our practices in light of the electronic records archives to see if what needs to be improved in our practices, clarified in our policies at least, to give us that foundation to move into the more and more complex formats. We'd be flying blind if we started with the most complex ones, but getting our feet wet with some of the workflow implications and some of the process implications of dealing with the most really basic electronic records we're going to come into contact with, at least in this generation. At least that was our approach.
I personally found the Doomsday example to be really interesting. So if you search on the web for 1986 Doomsday, you'll find several different sites, including one at the UK National Archives, which describes their migration project. One written by the actual project director who created the multimedia application, and he's got a whole explanation of sort of the history about it and his thoughts on why it became obsolete in such a quick time and what might be done about it. And then also the Chameleon project, which is the emulation engine that was written to try to emulate the software. And so if you want to sort of explore both emulation and migration and what the pros and cons are and how it played out in a real project, that's a really interesting thing to look at.
So we have a question in the back, loud and proud. And the question is, so how would we address, because we have all this legacy issue we now need to deal with, and the 74 Mars project really helps exemplify that. So where do we go from here, let alone moving forward? Any recommendations, suggestions?
Yeah, I guess it's a little bit too late to turn back the clock and convince them to build those systems in, right? And that's what we're encountering for most of the more complex ones that we, as archivists, haven't got in on the ground floor on. I'm afraid to say it may be lowering our sights a little bit. I mean, we can't certainly interpret a lot of these data formats. We can't read a lot of that. We can't drag out a lot of the metadata that might make these records come alive. So I'm not sure what we do after the fact to really bring out some of those characteristics and make them persistent over time, aside from setting our sights a little lower for some of the things that we have less influence about. And kind of accepting those losses to the extent they've already been lost. It's not a great answer.
I saw a picture one time of the Dead Sea Scrolls being reconstructed, and it the scrolls just fragmented into thousands of pieces, and they had people working at a long table trying to figure out. It was like basically a big puzzle. They were trying to figure out which piece goes with which piece. And I think that's going to happen with some of this data that was produced before people were aware of this problem. There will be sort of a new discipline called data archaeologists, whose sole job is to try to piece together these things the same way they're trying to piece together the Dead Sea Scrolls. I think going forward, I think the scientific community is actually pretty aware of this issue. I mean, the OIS standard was developed in part by NASA, and some of my colleagues who work on very large scientific data sets have told me that they take this issue very seriously because, you know, what's the point of sending a mission to Mars if you can't use the data 20 years later to support new kinds of research? So I think going forward it's going to be a lot better. But I think the sad truth is that there's probably a period in our history, maybe a 30 to 50 year period, where stuff is going to be lost. It really is.
Well, data archaeology almost certainly is to become a discipline. I'm not quite as optimistic as to the awareness of computer science and engineering of the problem, because there would be ways in which you could make files considerably safer. But then you would have to redesign some of the building blocks of current operating systems. And that has not yet really come to the attention of computer science. Why that is so is an interesting question, but not to be answered now. There's just one thing I have to say I'm very hopeful about. I don't know, but I would assume in the prom nights in this summer, probably something like 100 million photographs have been taken in the U.S. by digital cameras. Okay? 15 years from now, these kids will discover that most of them have gone. The first company who understands that there's a mass market for an affordable solution will get a lot of money. I'm telling this quite frequently, hoping that some company executive hears, so if anyone is present, think about it. But I really think that in that sense, we will find considerably more open ears in the industry in the future. Mark. Well, the short answer is I have been in Urbana on Monday to talk to the group there. No, I have been at the a group within the Open Grid Forum who works on DFDL in Urbana, Illinois. Just on this trip, actually. So we are in reasonable contact.
So how do we take the notion of appraisal to get the essential characteristics with the ERA's media-free concept?
No. It's not. It's
NARA initiative for media neutral with the NARA media-neutral schedules.
Yeah, we found that quite problematic. Coming from the records managers and archivists on this project, confronted with the idea of media neutrality and the fact that we wouldn't have a heck of a lot of knowledge necessarily of the record types and the data formats that would be coming 5, 10, 15 years in the future based on the schedules that we have written and approved. It's much more complex if we've got to just fly blind until the time of transfer and ingest. If that's the point when we learn much about these records, that might be a little bit too late to start thinking about those characteristics. And that's a tension, I think, throughout our agency and the idea of how aggregate schedules and big bucket schedules work for long-term and permanent records. They might be okay in a lot of business circumstances, but implementing that for an archival type of life cycle, given some of these concepts, I think that's a very good question. I don't know how that's going to work with the way we do appraisal and the way we try to handle that, because agencies are certainly entitled to create any kind of record type in support of their business process, and the schedules often are written that way. We're not going to have a heck of a lot of knowledge early in the life cycle to make some of these decisions and attempt to influence how the agencies are creating their records. And I think that's one of the issues that we found points of contention in our results in this, where that was not going to quite work smoothly.
We've got four more minutes.
So this is a question for the entire panel and the moderator. I think it's very interesting, the idea of sitting down and saying that there's a 93% chance that the migrated file is identical to the original file. But is that good enough for archives? Do we want to be in court in 50 years and saying to a judge, oh, there's a 93% chance that this document is really what it was originally, but it could be entirely different, too?
So let me start. Is 93% good enough?
Yeah.
If that's what we can do?
Or 85% or any, we'd almost be better off not knowing.
To me, how do you come up with that number? I mean, obviously, Dr. Thaler is able to come up with it. At the State Archives level, we have best effort. We do the best we can. That's all we can do. And that's our answer.
Okay. I should say that this was not assumed to say there's a 93% probability that you have it, but you have 93% of the information there is. And it's used only for one specific purpose, not to evaluate a tool. So your IT department tells you I have program A, which costs $100, and program B, which costs $50,000. And then you should be able to evaluate if you apply A, and you get 90%, and B, and you get 97%, you have to decide whether the 7% are worth 49,900. So that's roughly the idea behind it.
I'll say that the question is, what's the alternative? So I tried to use in my talk two alternatives, which showed that if you don't do anything, you're going to lose access to the records completely in as short as 10 or 15 or maybe 20 years. So given that you're facing the fact that these are decaying with the tooth of time gnawing on them, as Dr. Thaler said, the question is, what are you going to do? And whatever you pick, you want to have the most likelihood of success. Now, is it perfect and is that good enough? That's a question for you all to decide. I'll draw on an analogy that Dr. Thibodeau, the ERA program director, uses, which is, you know, the most famous record probably that the National Archives has is the Constitution of the United States, and it has some decay on it. There are a couple of words that have some possible water damage or oil damage or something, and some of the words are not quite legible. So even with something that the United States spends so much time trying to preserve and make sure remains undamaged, even that has a little bit of damage as well. So is that the authentic Constitution in Constitution Hall? I think it is. So I recognize the discomfort that this whole discussion has with people who think that who are focused or have been focused in their career on physical preservation, because the technological obsolescence introduces a whole new set of problems that are really complex and really actually, to my mind, kind of unsettling. So I don't want to take away from that, but the thing I would just say is, what's the alternative?
And Rick, you stole my example, so I feel bad about that. But yeah, I mean, outside of the realm of digital records, we do that all the time with photography collections. As those degrade over time, we do what we can. We accept that we're going to lose some of the quality of the original. That's just the way we do it, and applying our best practice to whatever professional standard we've established that meets our archives' needs, presumably with an eye toward future resource use and what the user is going to want from us. But we're never going to get 100%. We're never going to have the original. We can spit back the original bit stream that's been authenticated and let the user do whatever he or she can do to make that come alive again. But it's our responsibility to kind of accept a standard that we have to meet. And, you know, money plays into it, technology plays into it, and just professional practice will play into it. But aiming for 100%, we're not going to get there.
That concludes session 505. Thank you very much.